Hello and welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Another beautiful day in the neighborhood. What's up, Ryan?
Not much. I'm excited today to talk about trust. And before everybody goes to sleep, this is how you can actually save yourself millions of dollars and also celebrate your life better when you pass away, because people won't be fighting over your stuff. So as pilots, we're making more than we've ever made. We have more assets. We're buying stuff. We're making moves. You listen to this podcast for 112 episodes or so now. You probably are financially savvier and you're going to make money now, right? You're going to make more money now. So you need to figure out a way to protect those things in a trust. And we break that down. And one bonus at the end that I want to make sure everybody stays for is everybody talks about this due on sale clause. How do you transfer a property from your personal name into another entity?
For asset protection.
Yeah. And people have said, oh, because you get the asset protection and you get to put it in your other, in your new entity. And people have always like, yeah, but there's this due on sale clause, meaning that the lender can call the note due. And then people say, oh, well, that never happened. Don't worry about it. Well, guess what? It's happening now. So Amanda is going to tell us how to do that without the due on sale clause. So there's going to be an amazing tip at the end that I've never heard of before. Actually, I heard it for the first time while we recorded this. So pretty excited about that.
Excellent. Yeah. And I think the general majority of pilots understand the fact that a trust is a good idea. We've seen a lot of our investors transfer their interests from their personal name into a newly formed trust. We talk about that during the episode. But I don't know if I'm alone. I don't think I am, that there's a lot of confusion around trust: revocable, irrevocable, land, grantor, asset protection trust. There's all these different types of structures. And man, I just have so much more clarity after this episode.
So do I. I'm like, yeah, ready to go.
This is excellent. So today we have Amanda Winalda. She is an attorney at Anderson Business Advisors. Ryan, you got...
Yeah, I mean, Amanda and I go way back, you know, seeing each other at the Anderson Advisor event, and she's done a tremendous amount of speaking on this topic. And she's also a licensed attorney, and she basically is one of the executive attorneys at Anderson. And I can go into a long bio, but here's the thing. Amanda comes from a family that had a big family business, owned a lot of real estate, owned a lot of assets, had an operating company, has had people pass away. And she not only knows how to set up your land trust, your wills, estates, all this stuff, but she's actually lived through it. And I think that's why I like the folks at Anderson so much, is because like Toby and those guys and Clint and everybody, the partners, they're not only up there telling you like how to do this, but they actually invest in real estate. They own tons of real estate. They set up their own trusts. They're living and breathing this stuff every day. And they have over 20,000 clients. So Amanda knows what she's talking about. So I've been trying to get her on the show for probably a year.
Yeah.
I think we've rescheduled this like three times.
We've been hot on the trail. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of my fault why we rescheduled some things. She came up with her. So anyway, we are so excited to finally bring her on. This is going to be one of our top listen to episodes for sure. So get out your pens and paper, everybody. Get ready to copy. We're going to tell you, we're going to drop some big nuggets here. This is going to be an episode that you're not going to want to listen to on 1.5 or 2.x speed. You're going to want to slow this one down and consume all the knowledge. So with that,
let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Happy to be here, guys.
Before we jump in, I'd love to hear a little bit more from you about your background and how you got into your career, your profession, and how you ended up at Anderson Advisors.
Sure. I have kind of a crazy backstory. My attorney origin story, not villain, because we're not on the bad side of being attorneys. We're on the preemptive medicine side here. But I actually worked in sports television and broadcasting for 8 years, and then found that lifestyle wasn't super conducive to being a mom. I've got 6 kids with my husband, 3 stepkids, 3 younger ones. And so instead, I was a stay-at-home mom for several years and found that that was not super conducive to my sanity. And so I did the super sane thing of going to law school. My family has had a business in Southern California. My grandfather started it when he came back from World War II, and we've worked in it for three generations. Everyone in the family works there except for me. And part of what I saw growing up was how hard it was for business owners, especially on the tax side. You work so hard throughout the year, and then it seems like the government just takes everything that you've worked for in taxes. So part of what I wanted to accomplish in going to law school was learning more about business, learning how to save on taxes. That was kind of my focus there. I worked at the IRS chief counsel's office. I worked in a accounting firm in downtown LA and saw kind of the strategies that wealthy people were using to not only protect themselves, but to save money. And that had a real big impact on my personal situation. And so when we moved to Las Vegas from Southern California, I found Anderson Advisors, and it was just this really happy marriage of tax and legal. You don't see that too often out there. For a lot of people, you're going to a CPA and they're giving you tax advice, and then they're saying, hey, go to your attorney to get those legal questions answered, and vice versa. And then you're stuck there running back and forth trying to translate between these two professionals, and you don't even really speak either language. And so that's what I love about being here. We do tax, we do legal. I run our land trust and deed department. But because I have such a strong background in tax and estate planning, I do a lot of teaching. And we do a lot of teaching. We have a lot of free information available online. We do live events, which is where I met Ryan initially, and you've been at one of our live events, Tate. So that's my background. Happy to discuss any of those things, although it's quite a lot to go over in one podcast.
The biggest question I get is, like, you know, a pilot will work for an airline, and as part of their benefit, they get a free will, right? So they'll be able to go to, you know, some authorized person and they get a will. And you go in and they sort of, you sort of build this will, and then you think you're kind of set, but then later on you hear that you also need a trust. And so you're kind of like, but I already have a will. And everyone, and I'm like, yeah, but you really need a trust. And you sort of go down this road of like, what's the main difference between a will and a trust? And I think a lot of people, once they realize there's a substantial difference, they're like, holy cow, I got to go out and get a trust as well. I know we're going to get into some complex subjects today, but can you just kind of, for the basic understanding, like what the difference is between a will and a trust?
100%. So when you are saying, should I get a will or a trust? The big thing that comes up is probate. We want to avoid probate. Probate's a process that your family actually has to go through when you pass away. And you have to do that if you have a will. A will has to be submitted to a court. A case has to be opened. A judge has to go through all these formalities to say, yes, this is a legally binding will. Appoint someone to be the executor of the estate. And then you have to send out notices to anyone who potentially could be an heir. And then they distribute property. That process not only can take a long time, but it's also very expensive. Each state sets the amount that an attorney or an executor can be paid, and that's sometimes based on the gross value of the state. So if you're particularly wealthy, that can add up. And even if you're not wealthy, a chunk of your estate is gone out the door before your heirs can even get it. And then it's also very public. Court records, you can go to the courthouse and look them up. So everybody kind of knows your business. So that's the downside of the will. And so that's the main thing we're trying to avoid. With the trust, the total opposite. You don't have to go to court. You name a trustee, they immediately step into your shoes and can distribute property per your wishes. You're still setting out all of the details of what you want to happen, but no court intervention is required, which makes things less expensive, allows your family to do things more quickly, and keeps things private for you.
So, Amanda, this has really helped me frame a trust versus a will. When you have something in a trust, my understanding is the assets get titled in the name of the trust. For example, your will might say, John and Susie get the house 50-50. But the trust, when it's in a trust, the house gets titled in the name of the trust, right? Your rental property. So anything, any beneficiaries, the trust is pointed to. And so there's no, you're basically eliminating ambiguity of where this stuff goes when you pass, because it's in the trust, entitled in the trust. So when I went through this process, my attorney really made sure that I was putting all of my assets in the name of my family trust, because otherwise they wouldn't be captured under this trust thing. So with that, I think it's also worth noting that there's asset protection that comes with a trust. So if you're if you have your assets in a trust, then you have an extra layer of protection while you're living, right? Is that, does that work?
Sort of. So I like to think of a trust as a wagon that we carry behind us throughout our life. And we can put assets in, we can take assets out while we're alive. It's really our alter ego, but it is very important to what's called fund the trust, which means title the assets into your trust. And so that can be your home, just directly titled into your trust. It can be your, if you've got an asset protection structure and a holding company, it's titling that into your trust. And so then when you pass away, your trustee just picks up that wagon and they can continue on doing investments within the wagon, within the trust, until maybe if your beneficiaries are minors, until they're older, and then you're taking things out of the trust and distributing it. So that's how I like to think of the trust. It is very important to make sure that the assets get into the wagon, though. And so that's what your attorney was doing there. That being said, you do have the opportunity through what's called a pour over will to capture any assets that maybe you forgot about. Or the classic example is you close on a property, you walk out of the title office, you get hit by a bus. We're talking final destination type stuff here. And it doesn't get into your trust. That pour over will allows you to your heirs to do a quick, easy probate that basically the court says, hey, that asset, we know they meant to put it into their trust. They just didn't get a chance to. We're going to quickly put it in the trust and then everything flows that way. So it's kind of a misconception that you need a trust or a will. You actually need a trust and a will, but just having that will isn't going to quite get you where you want to be. In terms of asset protection, because the living trust is your alter ego, there's real no legal liability protection from creditors or from debts that you owe or liability that may be coming off of your assets like rental properties that get sued. You really do have to stack that with a structure. We're holding companies, holding your investments in things that have charging order protection, anonymity, holding your properties and individual LLCs, or what my company does is land trust. And then that whole thing, I like to say it's like little Russian nesting dolls. The property goes in the trust goes into a LLC, the LLC goes into the holding company, and then it's so easy to just put everything into your wagon. You can do that with essentially two pieces of paper, and then that funds your entire thing in. And that's what gives you the asset protection.
So I'm an airline pilot, and I'm just flying the line, and I got nothing. I just got my 401k and I got my high income.
I still say you do, because when we talk about a living trust, we're not just talking about the trust. We really, it's an entire estate plan. And so number one, you can, if you've got your 401k, that's what we call like a transfer on death or a pay on death account. You can actually name a beneficiary. So if you have one person you want it to go to, sure, name them as the first beneficiary, but then we want our trust to be our secondary beneficiary just in case that other person passes away before us. Typically, that's going to be a spouse. If we've got our kids, then you can distribute it through the trust. That's going to make it easier. But the full estate plan comes with so many other things. So you've got your trust, you've got your pour over will, but you've also got a medical power of attorney, a financial power of attorney, all of the HIPAA waivers that are your representatives are going to need to be able to get medical information from your doctors. And you need those even if you don't have assets. I mean, we had a client who had a college age son. He graduated and he had his big boy job coming up. And he was like, I'm going to go backpack around for a while, have my last bit of fun before real life starts. And he went over to Southeast Asia and he got in a really bad accident on one of those little Vespa things. And he was in the hospital for a long time. And because she didn't have his financial power of attorney, she couldn't access his bank accounts. He didn't have assets, but he had a car payment. He had a student loan payment that started to come due. So he comes home, and when he thought he was starting out, getting his life going, he was actually behind because now his credit score is in the tank. He can't get loans. He can't get a house. he's behind because of those things. So we want to have those other pieces in place. Additionally, there's what's called a living will. In some states, it's called an advanced healthcare directive. That is what we kind of look at. I look at this as your last gift to your heirs. It tells them exactly when or when not to essentially pull the plug on you. I mean, we've heard of these cases. The big one that I'm old enough to remember is Terry Schiavo out of Florida. She was in a coma for 14 years, and her husband had to go through court and fight with his in-laws because he wanted to pull the plug because he knew that she didn't want to live in that persistent vegetative state. And she had been doing it for over a decade. But her parents thought she had a right to live. And so she didn't have anything in writing from herself that told anyone what was going to happen. And it became a nationwide thing where Congress was getting involved. The governor of Florida was getting involved. It spurred all kinds of legislation all over. So we don't want our loved ones to have to go through that. They're already losing you. So then to make them make that choice, that's not something I want to put on anyone that I care about. So all of these other documents are part of that estate plan. And even if you don't have assets, even if you don't have kids or a spouse, they're really important to have still.
This is great. Okay. So I want to walk this back a little bit to foundational level in the interest of no pilot left behind here. You know, this is a really in-depth topic. And we talked before the show that we might have to have you back on to explore some more details around all of these powers of attorney and, you know, land trust, and all these different types of trust. But let's walk it all the way back. And I love the analogy used of this wagon behind you, Amanda, because before the show, I went to ChatGPT and I said, explain a trust to a child. And I like what it spat out here. And I want to get your take on it. It says, imagine you have a big toy box. This is the kid, right? Instead of keeping all your toys in there for yourself, you tell your parents, I want you to take this toy box and give the toys to my little brother when he turns 10. So your parents take the toy box for you. And the toy box is the trust. You are the one who puts the toys in. So you are the grantor. Your parents are in charge of taking care of it. Now they are now the trustee. And your little brother is the one who gets the toys later, and he's the beneficiary. So can you kind of walk through that? Because I wanted to lay out that example so that people can really understand this at a fundamental level. Let's talk through who are the people involved in a trust, grantor, beneficiary, trustee, and break down those rules.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what you said is exactly right, although it's a bit morbid to think about the child being the one that passes away in this situation. But
right, right. Well, and of course, maybe there isn't an event where they pass away. Maybe it's, Or maybe the beneficiary is the child themselves.
And that's exactly what it is. So while you're alive, you're all three parties. So you had it right. The grantor is the party who puts the property into the trust. The trustee holds title or legal title to that property and manages it for the benefit of the beneficiary of the trust. While you're alive, you're all three parties. So that's why we say it's kind of like your alter ego. You put all the property in because trust, living trusts are typically revocable. You can take everything out. You can terminate the trust. You can start a completely different trust. Although a good attorney will draft your trust in a way that you don't have to really scrap it. You can always amend it throughout your lifetime. And then you're the trustee. So there's really no, if we're looking from an asset protection standpoint, there's not a lot of anonymity there. So we're usually stacking this with LLCs or with other types of anonymous trusts. But just straightforward, you're those three parties while you're alive. And then when you pass away, you've named that successor trustee. That's typically going to be somebody who's good with finances, somebody that you trust. And then your beneficiaries may or may not be the same person. Most of the time, they're not. We think of our beneficiaries as our kids. If you don't have kids, it can be nieces, nephews. It can be charitable places, charities. We have a lot of clients who give a little bit or most to their kids, but then we always have a remote contingent beneficiary. It's called, if none of our beneficiaries are around anymore, it's going to ultimately go to usually a charity that we know is going to be around. So those are the three parties and how they interact depending on whether you're alive or after you pass away.
I want to dig into the trustee, because this is something that can be confusing for someone who's just coming into it. They're going, wait a minute, why am I signing over my rental property or my house to this other person? Maybe it's an attorney, but when you're live, you can be the trustee. At some point, you pass that role over to someone else, or you can do it immediately, right? How important is it to select that trustee carefully?
Oh, I mean, it's of utmost importance. And again, you're the trustee while you're alive. In very few circumstances would you hire an attorney, or even there's corporate trustees out there, typically banks, to manage your assets while you're alive. That being said, once you pass away, if you don't have someone, I mean, we have clients who don't have any family or close friends that they would trust. Just because they're a good friend of yours doesn't mean they'd make a great trustee, right? My brother-in-law had that situation. The trustee was his friend from childhood who was a financial planner. Didn't do a great job, even though he had the skills, just didn't. And so you want to have somebody that you trust, but also has the skills. For myself and my husband, my sister's our trustee. She is trustworthy. She has a degree in finance. She ran the books for our family business for many years, still does. Whereas my brother is going to be the parent or the guardian to my kids. They just have different skills. So you want to pick the right person for what you're asking them to do. If you are going with an attorney, usually you're doing some sort of corporate trustee, because again, an attorney is an individual. They could predecease you. And so with the corporate trustee, you're looking at some fees, which are typically a percentage of the trust estate. That's kind of a last ditch scenario. Most people, their estates are not going to be so massive or expansive that a normal person with basic financial info is not going to be able to handle it. And they can always hire an attorney to help them, likely have to hire an attorney at some point to do like deed drafting or property transfers to the beneficiary.
So if I'm an airline pilot and I just have a primary residence, I've got a few syndication deals that I've invested in and a couple of kids, spouse, what structure would you set up for that person?
Yeah. So we'd have our living trust. That's going to be at the bottom of all of our structures. And that's, again, the full estate plan. That's your foundation. And then we're putting things into that wagon. So for your personal residence, if you're concerned about anonymity, if you don't want anyone to know that's kind of where you live, which privacy is a big issue for some of our clients, for all of our clients, really. Some of them for more serious reasons than others. Some people just don't want people to know where they live. Some have genuine safety concerns, stalkers, or they're kind of public figures. They don't want just anyone showing up on their doorstep. We can use what's a different type of trust, still a revocable grantor trust, but it's designed to keep your name off title. Remember, for your living trust, you're the trustee. So anything titled in your living trust has your name on it. My living, Amanda Winalda, as trustee of the Amanda and Eric Winalda Living Trust. That's what it would say on title for anything. So if we want to pull our name off of it, we're going to use a personal residence trust. It's designed to have someone else be the trustee. We have an attorney of ours be the trustee temporarily so that his name stays on title, but you maintain your privacy. So that would be for your personal residence. And then for any business investments, we really want to be putting that through a business entity structure. Number one, because we don't want liability, our personal liability crisscrossing into our assets and vice versa. With syndications, you don't have a ton of, you're a limited partner. So there's no liability coming from the asset itself, but we're out there driving cars, doing things, flying airplanes. We don't want any of our personal liability to pierce into our assets and have those be drained because of some lawsuit we've gotten involved in. So with syndications, we're typically just doing a simple Wyoming holding company. You can invest in multiple syndications through that. And then we're putting that Wyoming holding company into our wagon, into our living trust. And so that's a pretty basic structure for the type of situation you're talking about.
I'm so glad you brought up the syndication thing, because people always, like Tate and I get asked all the time.
Yeah, all the time.
Right. $1 million question. Should I put my syndication in my personal name, my trust, or my LLC? And my response is, and again, I'm not giving any tax, legal, or investment advice. Talk to Amanda and the lovely team at Anderson about this stuff. But my under, you know, I had an investor who's, you know, worth hundreds of millions of dollars, put, you know, 100K into, you know, a bunch of deals with us, you know, 30 plus deals. And he asked me, you know, he got his attorney involved and said, hey, I don't want to open myself up to liability with my $100,000 that's in Ryan's deal to my whole net worth, which is hundreds of millions of dollars. So if somebody slips and falls and cracks their head open on Ryan's property, I don't want them to come, be able to come after me for this. And my understanding is they can't because you're a limited partner. But on the personal side, if he's out doing something negligent, whatever, something happens, somebody finds a reason to sue him unrelated to the investment, then they could come after the investment that he's made into my deal. So it's not a matter of you protecting yourself from liability on my project. It's about you protecting your assets and your personal holdings. And so that was kind of my like epiphany that I had, because I've heard
from someone who's suing you personally.
Yeah, it's you. It's your protection. So, you know, when, you know, we always joke, we kind of like rattle off, we're not giving any tax, legal, or investment advice because we can't. Number one, we're not licensed attorneys. I mean, Amanda is, but me and Tate, we can't advise you on what to do with your personal situation, but we can tell you that you're a limited partner, which is legally and factually correct. Like, you have limits of your liability. That's the whole point of a limited partnership.
Right.
But what you do on your own time is between you and your, you know, attorneys and your financial team. So I just think that that cannot be understated. Like, this is a thing that's protecting you and your assets. So, you know, look into doing something like that. And I will say one more thing before you're like, oh my God, I can't invest in your next project until I have this elaborate trust set up, right? Because I'm just getting ahead of it. You can always transfer, mm-hmm. right? So Tate and I allow you. So if you want to not miss out on the next deal, you can invest in it in your personal name. Don't worry about it, right? No different than your 401k is probably list your beneficiaries of your 401k are not your trust right now, right? Like, it's probably you and your spouse or whoever, right? Or, you know, whoever you've listed on the beneficiary of a 401k, you can transfer it later. So you can actually switch it out on a later date. So you don't have to wait for the perfect entity structure necessarily to do that. So, yeah, can we talk about that? Like 401k, like if you have a trust and you have it set up, like can we talk through the beneficiary change?
I mean, you're exactly right on the liability issue and that secondary issue. When you realize that you don't have a trust, or when you realize that liability is a two-way street, there's a sense of urgency that comes up. So we definitely want to get started on those things, but that shouldn't stop you from continuing to do the investments that you have. And question for you, I mean, if I close in my personal name, how hard or easy is it to then transfer it to my LLC?
24 hours.
Yeah.
A couple of pieces of paperwork.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So
yeah,
it's not something that is difficult. You shouldn't hold off on doing that just because, and we can set up a Wyoming holding company for you in probably the same amount of time, 24-hour turnaround time. The hardest part people have in that process is choosing a name, because they think for some reason it needs to have some sort of significance, when really it could just be a random series of numbers and letters and it works just fine. So getting that set up, we can be doing things simultaneously, and we shouldn't be holding off on our investments because we don't have our trust or we don't have our holding company set up. All of those things can, we work with clients who are just starting out. We work with clients who have been investing for decades and now see that they need protection. We can get it set up simultaneously. From the liability aspect, you're 100% correct, Ryan. It's a two-way street. And so as a limited partner, and again, I am an attorney, but I'm not your attorney. So I am talking about legal and tax subjects generally, but they may or may not apply to your specific situation. But generally speaking, a limited partner is just that. Their liability is limited. It is not zero, though. You are liable up to the amount that you put into the investment. So you could be, as if the limited liability company itself is sued because someone fell and hurt themselves, you could potentially lose what you put in, but you'll never lose more than that. You'll never have additional personal liability coming from that asset. So it's relatively safe to do it in your personal name. But when you're looking at liability from the other direction, that changes things. Because again, we're out there, we're doing things. I live in Las Vegas. it is wild out on these streets. People are crazy. And so,
well, and there's an injury attorney billboard.
Sign. Oh, they're everywhere.
Yeah. Like everywhere you look. I was shocked at that. I've been to Vegas twice in the last 2 weeks, and my jaw is on the floor with how many injury attorney billboards there are.
They're everywhere. And that largely has to do because of all of the casinos. They are rich companies. And so they have a target on their back when it comes to liability. But that's across the board in our society, unfortunately. We have very litigation hungry people out there. And so even if there's not a lot of fault, if they can make it look like there's fault, or even if an injury is not terrible, we're going for everything. I mean, not we, I'm on that side of litigation. We're the good guys, but I mean, and that makes sense. If somebody's injured, they should be able to be put in back into the position they were before that injury. They need to be compensated. But because our society is so litigious, that's what we're looking at. So if you have any liability, a judgment against you, a creditor, you don't want them to be able to reach into and have pick and choose what they're going to take from you. If you have this holding company and all of your assets are in a structure, not to get too deep in the weeds of the legalities, but there's a barrier there. Sure, you still have to pay that judgment. You still have to pay that creditor, but you have control over how that's done. You are paying them from maybe just your regular salary and doing it piecemeal. And because they're not getting that huge payment, maybe they're more willing to settle for a lower amount, or they're more willing to settle for an insurance maximum. They're not able to reach into your entire portfolio, whatever it may be, whether it's a limited partnership deal, and get those rents just paid directly to them, or take an entire rental property. And so we're preventing that. You can keep everything in your structure, in your holding company, and continue to reinvest, continue to build wealth while having control over how that creditor is paid.
Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to ask is, okay, so I am a limited partner in a syndication, so I have a limit to my liability. But what if I'm doing the deal myself and I'm the operator? Do I take on more liability? I mean, I know we're a little off topic from trusts, but I think it's important to know, like, one of the benefits of a syndication is the limits of your liability as a limited partner versus you going and doing it yourself. You're kind of opening yourself up to more liability potentially, correct?
Oh, for sure. I mean, a limited partnership will always have limited partners, but it will also have a general partner. And that general partner has unlimited liability. That's how we get the limited liability for the other partners. So generally, if you are going out and doing it yourself, you're not doing it as yourself. You're setting up a separate company, maybe an LLC, maybe a corporation, to act as that general partner. So when you're out there doing the deal, you're like you, Ryan, you're not out there as Ryan Gibson. You're out there as Ryan Gibson of Spartan Investments. And so even though Spartan Investments yeah. might have some liability as the general partner in that specific deal, you as Ryan do not. You're putting on a different hat when you're doing that work, and then you get to take that off and the liability stays with the company instead.
Okay, one more drill down into that. So then I hire a property management company and I can indemnify myself from liability and put that on the property management company too, right?
So let's make sure we connect this with like a rental property that you own. So let's say you own exactly. a single family home that you rent out, but you hire a property manager to manage it for you.
So it's going to be different yeah. whether or not you're the property manager and you're doing that through a separate company. You're just putting on your property manager hat to do it rather than doing it as an individual, or if you're hiring a third party. So if you're hiring a third party, you will be yeah. limited on what liability you can shift over to them, because they're somebody else. They're not going to want to take that liability either. So you're kind of coming to an agreement there. And then if you're doing your own property management, and this is more likely happening in individual rental property situation, although if you are starting your own syndication, I would also recommend setting up a separate property management company. So all of that activity is not happening in the same place. You're then now on both sides of that transaction. You're the property owner through an entity, and you're the property manager through an entity. So in that case, we want to shift as much liability over to the company that doesn't own anything. Because guess what? If your property management company gets sued, what's in there? Nothing. Even the rents it's collecting, that doesn't belong to that company. It belongs to the investors. Whereas if you're doing that management through the entity that owns the property, well, guess what that entity owns? The property. So if it gets sued, suddenly your property's at risk as well. So it's a great idea to separate that out, regardless of what type of investing you're doing, whether it's syndication or you're doing just your own rental properties. We want to be doing different activity in different entities, and we don't ever want to do any active activity in the same entity where we're holding our assets.
That's excellent.
And that actually applies to just regular businesses as well. For example, my family's business, we ran the business through an S corp, but all of the real estate and the fleet of vehicles were in separate entities. So you're not losing those. You can shut down operations. That business can declare bankruptcy fairly easily, but you still have the assets to build up something new on the back end.
And I'll say this as somebody who's, I mean, I own lots of real estate and I've been sued.
Well, yeah, it's not if, it's when.
It's not if, it's when. And everybody, you know, when I got into the business, like, oh, wow, you've been sued. Oh, my God. You know, geez, you know. And all of a sudden, and then I get around other business owners and it's like, oh, yeah, we got like 5 pending, 10 pending all the time. You're getting hit from every different way. Because here's the thing. Something's going to happen and it's going to be absolutely ridiculous. They're going to see that billboard on the freeway in Vegas. They're going to call that injury attorney. And then that injury attorney is going to spray everything that they can see. Right. So they're going to come after, they'll be ridiculous. They'll come after your property manager. They'll come after your property management company. They'll try to see how much stuff they can get to stick in a lawsuit. And so, you know, you're hearing this stuff and you're like, I don't need to do all this stuff. Just wait. It will happen. If something bad can happen, it probably will. Right. And so somebody said that to me years ago. And so we set up all this insurance and all these structuring. And guess what? It's protected me from all this stuff. I mean, Anderson actually helped me or my business separate out our holding company where we hold all the real estate and separate all the operating company, just like you said, Amanda, that doesn't own any of the real estate. And I'll tell you what, it saved me multiple times from any personal liability or liability with the holding company that actually owns the real estate. So this stuff is real. If you're getting into this, rewind that, watch it a few more times, you know, or call Amanda.
Well, and that was really well said, Amanda. And we'll have another episode. We had Clint Coons on a while back, who's an asset protection attorney at Anderson Advisors. We got to get him back on, and maybe Amanda, you as well, just to talk purely about asset protection. But I want to shift gears back towards the trusts and talk about the different types. Can we start with revocable versus irrevocable? These are terms that people hear thrown around and may or may not understand what they mean.
Sure. So the difference between revocable and irrevocable is one, you can take everything out and terminate it, and the other one, you really can't. The bigger picture is that when people who are using irrevocable trusts are typically doing so for either a tax or asset protection purpose. So when you pass away, currently you can leave over $13 million to your beneficiaries, your heirs, and not have to pay an additional estate tax. That hasn't always been the case, though. Estate tax, it's called an exemption. It at one point was $1 million. And so if your estate's higher than that, your estate's going to pay up to 40%, I believe, tax on that before anything goes to your heirs. So because it's so high, my uncle, his funny thing he likes to say during the holidays is it's a good year to die. But some years it's not as great of a year to die. So that's how we remove things from our taxable estate, is by putting them into an irrevocable trust, because that's kind of like a wagon with a lock on it. Now you can't take anything out. And so when you die, it's not included as part of your taxable estate. It's separate over there. Now, most people are nowhere near $13 million, right? And if you're a married couple, it doubles. So most people don't need an irrevocable trust for that reason. But if you have an asset protection situation, there are some other types of trusts that are irrevocable, like a Nevada Asset Protection Trust, a NAP. We have clients who know people are coming after them, may not be coming after them now, but know that in the future that's going to happen. And so that's an additional way to protect those assets, because if you're sued, those things are no longer in your name. They're in that locked wagon and nobody can go and get those. So that's the main difference there. Knowing most people listening, you just need a revocable trust.
Understood. Okay, so that irrevocable and revocable, is that an overarching term? Because there's how many types of trusts are there? I mean, there's land trusts and asset protection trusts, like you mentioned, grantor trusts. There's how many names are there out there for trusts? How many structures are there?
That's a hard one, because even certain trusts, different attorneys or firms out there will come up with a new name that's even really just more of a branding name. To rename something that we all already know exists, but as a way to convince people they need this new thing, right?
Because I think I've heard of dozens of different names for trusts.
Yeah.
So how many
irrevocable really and revocable are like umbrella terms?
Okay.
And then we have different trusts that we give different names that are mostly aligned with the purpose. So a living trust is for your estate plan. It's set up while you're living. Everyone kind of understands that term. Land trust is for, you guessed it, land. We're putting our real estate directly into that. It doesn't serve, it's the same type of trust. It's revocable, like a living trust. And it's a grantor trust, meaning the grantor and the beneficiary are the same party, at least initially. So it falls under both those categories. But it's drafted in a way that's specific to hold real estate and for a specific purpose. Whereas the living trust is drafted for a different purpose. So we do land trust, we do personal property trust. That's for, you guessed it again, personal property. Not to be confused with your primary residence, which I did spend like 45 minutes with a client in a little bit of an Abbott Costello who's on first situation where we went back and forth about personal property versus a personal residence. Your personal residence is the real property you live in. Your personal property is your stuff, your airplanes, your vehicles, your RVs, your things like that. So we're using differently named trusts for different things when we're building out your structure and your plan. But all of those are all revocable grantor trusts under that larger umbrella.
Why do I need all of these trusts for my airplane, my RV, and all these things if it doesn't give me asset protection?
You don't necessarily need them. And the trusts themselves aren't going to give you the asset protection. We're typically stacking that on with an LLC. And you guys can tell me more, especially with airplanes, you likely have to have some sort of license or have it registered somewhere, because that's a big thing that flies in the sky and is regulated by the federal government in some way. And so owning that either in your personal name or through a trust or through a business entity can be easier or harder, right? Sometimes people want to put their vehicles in an LLC, but guess what? Now it's a business vehicle and your insurance company wants to charge you twice as much. So it's very customizable. We're not necessarily putting everything into a business entity, especially if it's not business property. But we still want to be doing enough to hide your ownership of it or to give you some protection if they're high liability assets or if you've got other people using them or renting them out.
You talked earlier about anonymity and the potential of putting your primary residence into a trust that doesn't have your name on it. I want to ask you a question on that, because usually when you know, an individual or a married couple go out and they buy a house, they buy it in their personal name, and that's on the county records. Mm-hmm. So transferring it over into a trust that doesn't have your name retroactively, wouldn't people still be able to find that you live at 123 Main Street?
Not necessarily. So they would see that you previously owned the property, but unless it's a brand new build, somebody owned it before you and somebody owned it before that. And that's the chain of title. And sometimes the chain of title goes back hundreds of years. And just because I used to own a property, doesn't mean I own it now. I mean, my name's in the chain of title dozens of places, but that doesn't mean I live in any of those places, right? So anonymity is more what people can see looking through publicly available documents, see that you currently own or currently are attached to. So that's kind of the issue there with property. And when you're closing in your name, a lot of people want to close in directly in a trust or an LLC. And if you can do that, great. If you can keep your name out of the chain of title, that's great. But that's just not always possible because we use financing. We are leveraging our money, and he who has the gold makes the rules. And when the bank has the gold, the bank makes the rules about how you can close. And if you're the borrower, they want to see your name on title. And so then we're then transferring it to either a trust or an LLC so that it in a way that looks like you've sold it. So then that's how you get the anonymity.
I want to dig into that because there's transferring real property into an LLC can cause some issues. There, we always talk about the due on sale clause, right? Which most banks will never actually enact. You know, it's basically a provision in a mortgage when you close on it that says, if you sell this property, you owe us the balance of the mortgage, right? Because you don't own it anymore. So technically, if you were to transfer a property into an LLC, they could, in theory, trigger the due on sale clause.
And they will more often than not.
Yeah,
now.
For sure.
Because interest rates, they want to get out of these 2.5% interest rates, right?
Yeah. I'd be really careful. Like, I don't think anybody cared like 6 years ago, but now people really care about that.
But what about transferring it into a trust? Because banks are used to people putting properties in trusts all the time.
Oh, exactly. So when I first started at Anderson, people would ask about the due on sale clause. And we're like, in 25 years, we've never really seen that be triggered. Well, the only way it would be triggered is if interest rates just suddenly went through the roof. Well, guess what?
Went to 5.5% in 1 year.
Right. And
yeah,
so,
like they did.
Exactly. So now banks actually are looking for it. I mean, they're generally not in the business of foreclosing on properties. They're happy to just receive their payment. But now, if they can receive a bigger payment, force you to refi, force your new LLC to assume the loan and collect a fee based on the value of the mortgage at that point, they're going to do it. So they're looking at this. And we have seen this come up much more frequently. Transferring your property to an LLC. You don't generally have the same problem when using a land trust. And that is why we use them, or a big reason why we're using them now, because a land trust is a revocable grantor trust. Guess what else is also a revocable grantor trust? Your living trust. And so people know that that's a common thing to want to do. So there is an exemption now. This is in if you have a Fannie or Freddie backed loan, and you can look that up online. Google Fannie lookup tool, Freddie lookup tool. If your loan falls within that, which is 90% of the loans out there, their internal policy will not trigger the due on sale clause transferring to a revocable grantor trust. And so that's why it's great, right? So, and then.
Yeah, that's huge advice. Huge. I mean, that's amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
And then then attaching that trust to your LLC so you have the asset protection, because just the land trust itself isn't going to give you the liability protection. We're stacking these strategies.
Yeah. The only thing I'll say is that when you transfer a title, you have to check with the county assessor's office to make sure that there are no transfer taxes. For example, in Washington, D.C., there is a 1.6% transfer tax. So if you take your $500,000 rental property and you transfer it to new ownership, the city will charge you a transfer tax of 1.5% of the assessed value of your property. So we're talking about not insignificant money. That's a lot of money. So just make sure every jurisdiction, every county or whatever, the city, it is everybody's got a little bit of difference. So just check your transfer tax, call your title company in the local area, they'll tell you if it's going to do that or not. So you're not completely scotch-free, I don't think. So
yeah, exactly. That's basically what my land trust and deed department here at Anderson does, is that we pull your property info, we see how it's owned, and then we check what transfer tax exemptions there are. Because when it's a change of ownership, the county wants to charge you a fee, and you paid that fee when you bought the property. You probably just didn't notice you paid that fee because of everything else in there. And then they also want to reassess property. So if there's any sort of cap for your homestead and a new person is owning it, it's not their homestead, they want to bump those property taxes up to fair market value. So my team is researching that for our clients. And then we're sometimes recommending the land trust for exactly that reason, to avoid the transfer tax. And it's the same rationale. Counties want you to do estate planning. Every law is designed to either encourage or discourage you from doing something. And some of it's pretty obvious. We have speeding limits. We don't want you to speed. There's a law against that, right? So counties have exemptions because they want you to do estate planning. They want you to transfer to your revocable grantor living trust because guess what? it costs them money too to go through probate. They've got to have buildings. They got to pay court staff. They got to pay judges. And so they want people to easily transfer their property to their living trust. So there's an exemption from that transfer tax for those types of transfers in most places. And so because our land trusts fall within that exemption, we can usually get it done without that additional fee.
Okay. Follow on question to that, because this applies to or will apply to nearly anybody listening to this show at some point. You own a property, the mortgage on it's 3%. It's owned in your personal name. You're not living there anymore. You're either renting it out or you're planning to rent it out. How does that person get asset protection on that without triggering due on sale clause or causing issues with this transfer tax?
Yeah.
So is there a way to use the land trust in addition to, well, and still get asset protection?
Yeah. And so that's why the land trust is kind of perfect for this situation, because if you transfer that property that has a loan in your own name and you go to an LLC, the lender's looking for that. They're going to say, hey, you don't own this property. Or I've seen it where it's a particular type of loan, like a VA loan, where you're required to live in the property for a certain amount of time. And then they even see something as small as the property tax statements going to a different place. And they call you up and say, hey, you're supposed to live here. Why are the property taxes going to this other address? And so that can cause issues. Using the trust solves all these problems. You don't have the transfer tax. You don't trigger the due on sale clause. You can give that address, that trust, any kind of address. You can have the property tax statement still sent to the property. You can use a virtual PO box that usually doesn't raise any eyebrows. And then even if the lender notices it, they're going to say, hey, you transferred to this trust. What's going on? And you can hand them a copy of the trust and say, it's just my trust. You can see my name. I'm the grantor. I'm the beneficiary. Oh, yeah, I'm using an attorney or I'm using an LLC as the trustee. I'm doing that for privacy purposes, but the trust is still owned and controlled by that grantor beneficiary, and that's still me. And because it falls within the same type of trust as a living trust, you're not going to have those same issues with triggering that due on sale clause.
Now, because it's a revocable trust, the trust itself does not provide asset protection. So how do you layer in the asset protection there? Can you clarify that?
Exactly. So we then want to assign the beneficial interest to an LLC. Liability flows to the beneficiary. So if the trust is sued, the trustee is responsible for defending that lawsuit. But if there's ultimately a judgment against the trust, it's the assets within the trust and then the beneficiary who's responsible for paying it. So we don't want you to be the beneficiary. We want to make an LLC the beneficiary and limit that liability. So takes two pieces of paper, DocuSign signatures, and we're assigning the beneficial interest over to an LLC that, of course, you own and control, but now it's not connected to you individually. And you're basically changing the beneficiary is what it is.
This is fantastic. This is why we have this podcast. You heard it here.
I'll be honest. This is the first time I've ever heard anything like that. And I think that's incredible, because I think we've all been trying to skirt the due on sale clause and, you know, just hope and pray that nothing was bad's going to happen. But like I said earlier, if it can happen, it will. And then you're going to be caught trying to pay off a loan that you didn't want to pay off, or they're going to make you refinance it into a higher rate.
Speaking of refinance, I got one more question on this, and that is refinancing. So one of the big pains that I have experienced in my personal portfolio is I have a property that I transferred into an LLC and I paid the transfer tax because the county that this property was in does not exempt, even though you're transferring it to an LLC that's wholly owned by you, they don't care.
Yeah.
They say, we don't care. We want our money anyway. Mm-hmm. So I paid the transfer tax going in. And then I needed to refinance it. So I had to pay the transfer tax coming out, refinanced it, and then I paid the transfer tax again going back in. You see where I'm going with this is this is not a fun process. So does the land trust make the refinance process easier?
Yeah. I mean, you avoid that transfer tax. If there's an exemption in the county to transfer to your revocable grantor trust, it typically works taking it out as well. So you're going to avoid
that.
You
would still need to take it out, though, in order to refinance.
Right. And so, again, when you're refinancing, she who has the gold makes the rules. So the lender's going to make the rules. If you're the borrower, They want to see you on title. Even if it's in your living trust where you're named as the trustee and the beneficiary, they still want it in your name as your legal capacity as an individual. So if you're planning to do a refinance or pull a HELOC, we encourage clients to do that before transferring to a land trust. But if your property's already in a trust, you can do it. I'm not going to say it's impossible. I've seen clients refinance in a trust. You have to go to what I call a cheers lender. It's where you go in, walk in, and everybody knows your name, right? And so small community banks, credit unions, where they're more interested in developing a relationship with you and having an ongoing business than just this cookie cutter stuff from the big banks. The big banks aren't going to, they don't need you. They're just going to go to the next person that's cookie cutter. So you can do the refinance in a trust. But if you're kind of stuck in that process or you've already got the lending lined up, you may have to close in your name or transfer the property into your name, tie up all the financial stuff, and then we're just moving it. Either I wouldn't move it back to the same trust because then that's pretty clear from the chain of title that you own it, right? So you had it in your name, you put it into your trust, you put it into your name.
That's a good point.
You go back to the same trust. That doesn't take a lot of leaps to assume you own that trust. But if you go to your name, your trust, back to your name, I would go to a new trust, or in your case with an LLC, maybe set up an LLC or set up a trust that's connected to that LLC and it doesn't look like it's going back and forth.
That's excellent. I like that.
Well, Amanda, we're about at time. And you just kind of lay out if somebody's like, hey, I want to do this, right? I'm an airline pilot. I got a couple things. What's their roadmap? What's like a 30, 60, 90 day plan? Because I remember when I went through my trust, I'll tell you, it took forever, right? Because I had to like go get all my, not my attorney, but I had to like, what do you do in all these situations? And you got to go around and you basically got to figure out all the things you got to put in there and all the titling. So can you kind of lay out, you know, what the next steps are for somebody and what they can kind of come to expect to pay and what does it cost and is there upkeep and all that
sure.
stuff?
Sure. So there are a lot of different moving pieces. You can kind of start all of them at the same time. Like you said, Ryan, the living trust, setting up that process and getting all of your assets in it can take some time. Not just because a pretty standard living trust is going to be well over 100 pages drafted, or if you have a lot of assets, it's a lot of things to move, but it's just a lot of really kind of questions that not everyone wants to think about. Oh, what's going to happen when I die? Who's going to get all of the things? I mean, I was an attorney for almost 5 years before I could pin my husband down to get him to even have these conversations. So I would initially start with that. And then you're most likely starting with a holding company and then building it out from there, depending on the type of assets you have. In terms of costs, that's going to vary widely, depending on the company you work with, the individual attorney you work with. If you're also concerned about tax issues, coordinating back and forth. I mean, that's why Anderson Advisors is such a great place, because we're going to start you off with a strategy session. So your first step would be to just call. I'm sure we'll have a link for you in the show notes. Schedule a free strategy session. You're going to sit with a senior strategist. Some of these guys have been doing this longer than I've been out of high school. And they're going to sit with you, take into account all of your assets, but also your goals. I mean, how you are structured, we want to make sure you have the power to borrow still. We want to make sure you can still leverage and reach the things that you want. And then not only just what your risk is, but what you're risk averse to. And so we build out a specialized plan for you. And then we get all of those pieces moving at the same time. And then we're only touching base with you for things that we need you to make a decision on. The name of your LLCs. And then we're putting them all together. We're putting them together in the order that they need to be put together to make sure that you have all of that anonymity and that asset protection. Because the living trust kind of moves along a little slower just because of those big, important questions that need to be answered by you, we can get that process started. And then once your structure is built, it really is like the Russian nesting dolls. It takes two pieces of paper to put the entire thing into your wagon, and then you're all set.
Fantastic.
Amazing.
We'll link to that in the show notes. Amanda, thank you so, so much for coming on. We'll have to have you back because this rabbit hole goes deep. I want to talk about power of attorneys and, you know, the issues of people being written out of wills. And all sorts of stuff. But this has been a fantastic primer. Thank you so much.
For sure. I'm happy to come back. We could do a whole episode on the wild stories out there of estate planning gone wrong.
That would be great. Oh, God. That would be great.
I think I've lived through some of that.
I think we learn by example, right? So
that's right.
Thank you again. We'll see you on the next episode.
All right. Take care, guys.
Thanks, everybody. Take care.